Good morning and welcome to Frankly Speaking. Today we'll be discussing Romance in the Supermarket, the incredible popularity of the romantic novel. I'm Helen Ackerman for George Mason University. You see them everywhere there are paperback books, supermarkets, bookstores, yard sales. You can pick them out by the covers. They all feature a blonde, a brunette, a redhead, entwined in the arms of an unbelievably handsome man. Harlequins, silhouettes, and their kin make up a lucrative 25% of the paperback book market, and their sales show no signs of dropping. These books have one of the most faithful readerships in the world, and most of the readers are women. What is it about these books that makes them so perennially popular, and why do they appeal so strongly to women? With me today to discuss this subject is Dr. Jan Cohen, chairperson of GMU's Department of English, who is currently researching the phenomenon of the popular romantic novel. Jan, what characterizes the popular romance?
Well, if I can talk about the major kind of popular romance and leave out some others for a while, it'd be easier to discuss that. I want to talk about popular romance as it's manifest in silhouette or harlequin books, for example. And they're very easy to define in surface characteristics. They're short, fewer than 200 pages long. They have standard kind of plot, a youthful heroine and a somewhat older hero who meet, dislike each other, who spend approximately 160 pages in a seesaw of mutual dislike and erotic fascination. A critical moment occurs somewhere before page 188, in which the hero is brought to confess his love for the heroine, to say the word love out loud, which is something he would never do previously, and things at that moment resolve happily with marriage in the offing. These are a distinctive group that I'm dealing with. I'm leaving out of consideration the costume romances, I'm leaving out the gothics, and I'm leaving out long romantic fictions written by name writers, 500, 600, 700 page novels, trying to look at the phenomenon by focusing on one type that is pervasive, but trying at least to keep it clean that way.
Now, you contend that these books are not literature, and in fact shouldn't be looked at like literature. What do you mean by that?
Well, I want to correct that a little. I would never say they weren't literature, but I would indeed say they can't be looked at the way we look at elite literature. Let me say a couple of things about that. As a student of popular literature, it seems to me crucial that we avoid making elitist discriminations about the materials we study. Anything is literature that is produced in print and tells a story. So I would assert they absolutely are literature. What I do think, Helen, is that they can't be studied from the same points of view that we have learned to study elite literature from. Because the things that we value in elite literature, complex plots, originality of plots, innovations in character, ambiguities of character, I mean, we love Hamlet best because we can't decide what he's really like, exquisiteness of language one way or another, all of these things are virtually non-existent in popular romance. So that if one goes to popular romance measuring against the standards of plot, character, and language of elite fiction, simply bound to be disappointed.
So how then should we look at this kind of literature?
Well, the idea that I am playing with presently is that the closest analogy we really have is ritual. And this has occurred to me in part from critical readings that I've done, certainly in the major work of the anthropologist Levi Strauss and his view of culture and ritual, but also by my own attempt to look at what are normally seen as the drawbacks, the failures of popular romance, and trying to understand them instead of as failures, as conditions of their own peculiar kind of success. So in other words, I think innovative plots are not wanted, ambiguous characters are not wanted, and interesting language is not wanted. Well, if I may be simple-minded for a moment, there are only really two answers you can come up with. One is that the audiences are all some kind of perverse masochists who like to torture themselves by reading very boring things about which they know the ending well in advance. or that something very different is going on, some completely different kind of dynamic is involved in reading these. And I think that repetition, the absence of surprise, leads toward an analogy with ritual, that the readers of these books pick them up because they are promised that they will undergo a familiar, an obsessively familiar experience.
Well, obviously there is an enormous demand for the repetition of the same experience because they have new Harlequins and new silhouettes on the shelves every month.
Yes.
Why is it that there is this need?
That's, of course, the crucial question, I think, for any study of popular literature.
Well, most of the readers of these books are women, is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
So it's some need that women have.
You have to start with that assumption, and you have to start with the fact that to some extent, and this is difficult, the needs that popular romance is answering are needs specific to contemporary society. But in some ways, since the tradition is at least a couple of hundred years old, there's something ongoing in the condition of women that they respond to. I've been trying to follow up the line that popular romance produces a useful fantasy for women in bourgeois society by providing ritual examples of how women rise in bourgeois society. Unlike men, at least until the very present, they were certainly not to rise by their own efforts. In fact, that was aggressive and unattractive behavior. And as anybody with any sense knew, the only way they could rise was by making a clever marriage, but that too was frowned on. So there's a kind of fantastic wish fulfillment in romance which allows women, both heroines and readers, to focus exclusively on questions of love, ignoring all questions of material advantage, and somehow having at the end a perfectly wonderfully rich hero fall into their hands so that they're married and live happily ever after and very wealthily ever after as well, without ever having appeared to search for that kind of advantage.
When you say rise, is it the economic rise women are dreaming about, or is it an increase in power?
I don't think you can separate the two. Male power and male control of money in our economy have normally been seen as essentially the same thing. If I can digress a moment to the 19th century, there's a very interesting study of domestic women's fiction in America from the 1840s and 50s. And the woman who wrote this study demonstrates that what happens in book after book is that male control over money is wiped away in these books. And a new kind of domestic order is established. More harmonious, more genteel, more fair in the distribution of both power and money. These are not romances, they're not fantasies in any kind of way. But I then began studying English and American romances from the 70s and 80s and found that this issue of money and power is indeed fantastically handled, that the general storyline I see is the establishment of the love interest for the heroine as soon as possible, and then you get rid of the guy because it's boring, so you send him off somewhere, maybe America, maybe Australia. And then the heroine's left on her own. And so for about 400 pages, these are considerably longer than the contemporary ones, she manages to survive, to end up with a good deal of money, to be very spunky, usually to demonstrate without being too aggressive her ability to come into control of money and perhaps rank if it's an English setting. And only after that does the hero come back and they get married, because that part is so dull that the authors are clearly not interested in it. The power and money motive in these is much clearer than it is in the contemporary Harlequin
silhouette. But there seems to be an emphasis there on getting your power and your money before you get there.
Exactly.
Money, which is very different.
Exactly. And I don't understand it yet. I mean, that's one of the kinds of things I want to find out before I can complete the writing of this book. But it seems to me that the desire for control and money is there for a couple of hundred years. But as you pointed out, whether it's an overt desire or whether it's a covert one seems to switch from Victorian times to the present, and I haven't the slightest idea why.
That's fascinating. What do you think this is going to mean to the women's movement? Do you think that these romances are going to lose their popularity as the women's movement develops?
That should happen. But it's a question I'm not informed enough really to answer. I think in order to, you'd have to have a very much realer insight into the condition and feelings of American women who are not working, who are not in positions of some authority, than most women in the movement have. I mean, most professional women do not know a great number of housewives, romance readers, and they seem to posit the future of women in America on their own experiences without knowing about this whole population. That's one thing I do think the study of romance might help us do, might help us understand our culture better, and specifically this audience.
I gather from what you're saying, though, that you do not really see that this is going to become an unpopular form of fiction, that you feel that there is a huge audience of women out there who are not really, do not find the women's movement sympathetic.
Yes.
And are still looking for what their mothers looked for and indeed their grandmothers looked for.
I think that's true.
What got you started in this line of research?
Well, after graduate school, I'd had enough reading other people's criticism and decided it would be fun to ask different kinds of questions of different kinds of books. And I've done a number of kinds of studies in popular culture. But specific interest in romance came from the work I did on Mary Roberts Rinehart. Her better-known works in her own life weren't mysteries, but her long romances, which were, I should say, in her memory, much more high class than Silhouette and Harlequin, but which have essentially the same structure to them in terms of women's fiction.
She wrote in the early 20th century, is that right?
That's right. She wrote for the first half of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to be interested then in the contemporary popular phenomenon of romance as a result of that work.
And how do you go about studying it? Do you spend a lot of time reading the romances?
I spend considerable time reading them. I end up writing notes on them that are almost as long as the books themselves. And the 19th century ones I read in the Library of Congress, sitting there in the main reading room among the scholars, reading these Beryl's Husband and Noreen's Revenge and other classy novels.
This line of study seems almost sociological rather than literary. Do you find it so yourself?
Yes, I think so. It may be more even like cultural anthropology. In any case, the questions one's finally asking are about culture, about groups within the culture, rather than about the works of literature themselves. If you're studying Henry James, you're really interested in Henry James's fiction, but reading these, you're interested in reading through the fictions, if you will, to the audiences beyond them, and to learn something about the society.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I'd like to thank you very much for being here today. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public service program produced by George Mason University, production coordinator Jean Hyde. For information about our guest or this program, please call area code 703-323-2138. I'm Helen Ackerman for the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.